Good evening, everyone. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters, and this Paradigm Shifter is a very special guest because I've been telling Spirit I want to learn more about death and the process of death. And in my door, in a wonderful envelope, comes a book by Lonnie Leary called No One Has to Die Alone, Preparing for a Meaningful Death. And boy, this is something we all need to learn about because welcome to the show, first of all, Lonnie.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's just a treat to talk to someone about death because a lot of people aren't all that enthusiastic about that subject. Have you noticed that?
That's right. They don't even believe they will die.
Yeah.
Yes,
and no, it seems like it's something we all do, isn't it?
It is, but it's a universal opportunity, yes.
Yeah, good. It's an opportunity. Now, what triggered, I know a little bit because of reading the intro story, which is really good, but I know something about what triggered your fascination. Why don't you share it with everyone?
Yeah, it was less a fascination and more a need, because when I was 13 years old, my mother died suddenly and unexpectedly as far as her children were concerned. My family was a normal family, like most in our culture, and even though my mother had a chronic disease, Guillain-Barré, at the time, everyone was dying of that in the 60s, but no one in my family talked about her illness, and therefore we didn't have any of the tools or skills to really cope with it. And so there was great denial, and when she died, it seemed as though she died suddenly. She was here today and gone the next. And really, it felt as though the rug had been pulled out from underneath me. I was the eldest of three children. And in my need to make sense of things and cope, I took over and kind of took care of the house and things like that, and really went into overdrive. But I vowed that this would not be a tragedy and that never, ever again would I feel as though I had left a loved one to die alone, because in my mind at 13, I felt great shame and regret on top of the guilt, because I felt as though, in fact, my mother was throwing up that morning, and I did the only thing that I thought was helpful, which was to take my two younger brothers out of the house to play so my mother could sleep, not knowing that she was dying. Mm. And when we returned later in that afternoon, my mother's bed was empty and she was gone. Mm. A friend had taken her to the hospital, but I never got to say goodbye or that I loved her at that time. And so in my mind, I made up the story in the absence of information, because no one was talking to us about how she died.
Just a minute. Was that in the 60s, Lonnie? Just to give us
a
sense. Okay.
Yeah.
Because they just didn't talk about what was kind of murky then, did they?
Right. Well, in with their best intentions, they thought that they were protecting children, mm-hmm. and that we wouldn't be able to handle or cope with the information. And so there was silence. There was silence around the illness beforehand, and then there was silence after she died.
Oh, my.
And so, and one of the big things that I teach families when I go in to do family counseling is that children need information. Because if they don't have it, they make up the story. And the fantasies are usually much, much worse than the reality. So,
well, you have a little vignette here where your mother had had been loving to you, and in your 13-year-old reaction, you pulled away, right?
Yeah, because, you know, I was 13 and trying to gain my own independence. And so when she very lovingly told me that she loved me, I kind of just, ugh, Mom, you know, and walked away from her. And then shortly after that, she died. And so my interpretation of my actions was that she believed that her only daughter didn't love her and she didn't fight to live. So therefore, her death became my fault.
Oh, my.
And
it's easy to have that happen, isn't it?
It's very easy to make that happen, because we so need to make meaning out of events. And as a child, when we don't have control, we try to make up our own control, and so it's lopsided and doesn't necessarily make sense, but my control was that it was my fault. Mm-hmm. And so I spent the rest of my life learning everything that I could about death and dying and grief so that never again, would a loved one be alone and I wouldn't know how to respond. I wouldn't know how to be there. So I did take myself back to graduate school and majored in psychology and specifically thanatology, which is the study of death and dying.
Hmm.
And then I had experience at the National Institute of Health doing research with children dying of AIDS, and I worked in 6 or 7 hospices across the United States and in hospital, the ICU, and in private practice. And I just learned and learned and learned from these very courageous people who were dying and so generous to share with me their experience of what it was like and, more importantly, what they needed.
Well, you know, something interesting, you're saying you learned and learned and learned, and my question, of course, is, well, what do we learn? Is it as unique as the dying process, as unique with individuals as our lives are?
Yes, I would say that the dying process reflects their the way they live their life often, but I wanted to be present for them. I wanted to do for them what I was not able to do for my mother, mm-hmm. which was to really be there for them and to validate their experience and allow whatever they needed. But in allowing whatever they needed, I needed to be told, again, in each specific case, what was it that they needed in order to die with peace and dignity and love? How could they die gently? And there were pretty consistent needs across people of all different races and ages and conditions. And so I try to teach that because I believe strongly that if people knew that they could respond, they would step into the process and be of enormous, significant help. They would know that they could make a difference with their loved one, and they wouldn't pull away from this last opportunity to love.
I guess the first question that is just about impossible for most people is talking about, or the first discussion is talking about that somebody's actually dying, right?
Yes, and what I find is that the dying really want to talk about that experience because it is the elephant in the room. It is what's happening to them. And when we don't allow the dying to communicate, we isolate them. We cut them off from what they need the most, which is real intimacy and connection.
Mm.
So we don't want to talk as much as we want to listen.
Mm-hmm.
But so many of us do not allow the dying person to talk about their experience. We respond by saying, oh, don't be morbid. Or when a dying person says, you know, I know I'm dying, so often the response is, oh, don't talk like that.
Well, yeah, because there's this whole thing of you're supposed to have tremendous hope and not be realistic about it all, right?
Well, you know, and I consult for hospices, and that's one of the things that we talk about all the time is that,
oh, it is.
You know, I never take away someone's denial because that can serve. It can be very functional, and it can help a person to cope. And I never take away a person's hope. But we can hold hope at the same time that we hold a realistic expectation that our life is ending. Because perhaps we cannot hope for a cure
mm-hmm.
any longer, there are still so many things we can hope for. And this is very, very important. We can help the dying person to hope for tenderness at the end of life, for connection, for intimacy, to receive care, to be surrounded by loved ones, to not be cut off from life. We can help them to hope, to know how their life was significant and how they've left a legacy for others. There's so much that we can still hope for, even in the very last days of life.
It sounds like you've worked mostly with people that kind of had a little bit of a heads up that they're going to be dying rather than somebody who was taken immediately. Is that right?
Well, I do work with both. I respond to sudden and unexpected trauma and death. But I think it's really important that we respond to people who are aging and ill and dying. And there, and I put this in my book that I do respond mostly to people who are ill and have a terminal diagnosis. But because 90% of us, this is significant, 90% of us will die from an age-related or an illness. And that means that we have the time now, right now, to think about the end of our life and what we value and what we want. Hmm. But most people do not have those conversations. They don't reflect on that. But if we did, and if we had those conversations in our families around the dinner table, it is a gift. It is a gift when I tell my daughter how I want to be cared for at the end of my life, what I want, what I do not want, who I want with me. Mm-hmm. If I communicate that to my daughter, then she is not left guessing. She is not left second-guessing herself. She will not be left with the guilt. She will be able to say, I am doing everything my mom wants. I am making a difference. And her grief after I pass will be different mm-hmm. because she participated in the way I asked her to participate. And so it really is a gift that we can give our loved ones.
So you're saying it's the acknowledgement of that very person who's crossing over that gives them, what, the power of their experience?
Yeah, it's the acknowledgement. So my daughter would acknowledge me in the ways that were meaningful to me because I taught her what was meaningful to me. Mm-hmm. But also she would be able to be there because she would know what to do. She would know what I need.
Hmm.
And so at the end of life, see, she wouldn't feel like I did when I was 13 years old. Oh my goodness, you know, I was such a bad daughter. I didn't help my mother.
Right.
I didn't know what she needed. I didn't know what she wanted. I wasn't there for her. My daughter, on the other hand, knows very clearly what I value, what I need, what I want.
You know, it's interesting. I love that. But I think in my lifelong experience, a lot of people will not make that plan together.
Oh, gosh, they won't. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my experience, too.
Yeah.
And so oftentimes I'm called into families. I'm thinking right now of a woman who's 97, and she does not have a terminal illness. She just has age, and she is declining and declining rapidly. And her 50-year-old daughter calls me into the home, and I say to her, what does your mother want? What does she need? And the daughter will say to me, well, we haven't talked about it. And I said, we need to talk about it for your mother. And she says, well, I can't start that conversation because she's going to think that I want her to die. That's
mm-hmm.
a very common response.
That's interesting.
If I bring this up, I'm afraid my mother's going to think that I think she's a burden and I want her to die and I want her to move along in the process. She says, I don't know how to start that conversation. So I will model that for them. And I usually, in my family, I will start with myself. So I might say to my husband, I'm so glad I've lived to be 59 years old because I figured out that I want to be an organ donor. And I want my tissue and my organs to be used if they can be. I know that I want to be cremated. I know where I want my ashes to be spread. And this is where I want to die. I do not want artificial hydration and nutrition if I have a terminal diagnosis or I'm in a coma. And on and on. I'm very, very specific. And I'm even going down different circumstances. And then I say to my family, and this is what I want. And I wonder if you've begun to think what you want, because it would be a great gift to me if I knew what that was. I want to be there for you, but I don't know how to be, I don't know what you want. So it would serve us both.
How old are your children? Can they handle that?
Well, my daughter is 33 now, but we have been having these conversations since she was 5 years old.
Good for you.
Well, it is a part of life. And now I've been having, you know, sex education talks with her too since she was 5 years old. They're one and the same. They're both life processes. They're both healthy, normal parts of life. And yes, we have to use the proper names for both sex, our body parts, and for death. So when I talked to my daughter from an early age, I talked about someone dying. I didn't talk about them going to sleep. I didn't say God took them. I didn't even say necessarily they passed on. Someone died. They no longer have life.
Hmm.
You know, they don't use this body anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So very, very clear, specific language.
So talk about the link between that kind of awareness and grief. Is that dependent on people's individual emotional makeup, or, you know, do you think if we understood and were attended to and were communicated with and we got to serve our passing parent or whatever, the grief would be ameliorated to a degree?
I think grief can be softened. I don't like to use the word closure, but I think we can soften grief when we feel, as the survivor or loved one, that we have participated, that we have been involved, and that we have made a difference. Grief can soften. The other thing that softens grief is when we can find meaning in the process. So if we can find meaning in the illness, meaning in the death, that can soften it. So an example, my strongest example would be, so I spent my life learning everything that I could.
Partially because your mom died, partially because it was your soul.
Because my mom died and I wanted to do it differently for my father.
Mm-hmm.
So sure enough, when my father was 83, he did call and say, you know that pneumonia we thought that I had? Well, it turns out that it's end-stage lung cancer. And I said, I'll be there. So I was on the East Coast and my father was in Hawaii, and I closed my business and my university classes that I was teaching, and I flew home, and I hoped that I would be here for 6 months helping him, because often from stage four, a terminal illness, you have, usually doctors can guess that you might have up to 6 months.
Hmm.
So I came home, moved in, and took care of him. And I found meaning in his illness and his dying and his death. This was my last opportunity to show him love, mm-hmm. to be the daughter that he deserved, and to do it differently. And I really perceived and lived and felt that this process was a gift to both of us.
Mm.
And every day, as one of the ways to cope, because it was, of course, very hard work, both emotionally and physically, but as a way to cope, I wouldn't go to bed, I wouldn't go to sleep until I was able to identify the gift in each day.
Oh, wow.
And there was a gift in each day. I just had to find it. So as hard.
And what would the gift be? Like a forgiveness or a connection or a poem?
There were so many gifts. One of the gifts was one day I said to Dad, you know, it's going to be up to me to write your obituary, and I want to do it right. So instead of me doing it alone, Dad, let's sit down and write your obituary together. And, you know, you tell me you are the author of your life, so I want you to name your life and give me the descriptors. And so we sat down and wrote this fabulous obituary, and in the process, the gift was that I learned so much about him and his life that I didn't know, and I thought I knew him better than anyone.
Aww.
But the laughter and the stories and what a gift.
Really?
But
he was open and willing, though, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
Mm-hmm.
But he was used to me talking about a death a lot, you know. I mean, so I had set the stage a long time. But also, I think what's really important is, yes, he was willing to, but I wasn't afraid. So I think my lack of fear, my lack of anxiety really encouraged this process. And I think we can do this in our families.
Do you think it just takes, like for example, did you go through a period of being kind of frozen or disconnected as a teenager? Did you have to go through that kind of period?
My teenage years were very difficult. Yes, mm-hmm. I was really wounded in, you know, because I was so alone with my grief. There was no one willing to talk to me about it.
Right.
And so I think the thing that helped me, my greatest tool during that period was writing, just writing. So I could move the grief out of my body. There are lots of different ways, you know, there's so many different ways that people can work with their grief, but I wrote about it.
Mm-hmm.
So paralyzed with grief, oh, you bet. And you know, kind of beat myself up with my regret and my shame about not being able to be there for my mother, but just the whole fantasy of what happened to her. And it was 20 years later that I found out, for instance, that my mother had not died alone. And in my 13-year-old brain, that was the picture.
She just went off to the hospital and died. Eh?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Horrible, horrible. So, you know, we just really, we can cope if we have information. We can cope when we find meaning.
Mm-hmm.
We can cope. And when we know we can cope, we participate.
I love that. And that's why the title of your book is No One Has to Die Alone. It's a choice.
Because the reason for the title of the book is because that is the dying person's greatest fear.
Hmm.
Not their physical pain, not even their imminent death, but their greatest fear is that they will be emotionally abandoned at the end of their life. And when I say emotionally abandoned, I'm talking about exactly that no one will talk about what's real and what's really going on.
Mm-hmm.
People talk about the weather when someone's dying, which is that's so painful to me when I watch that going on. It's as though somebody walks into can you imagine someone walking into a birthing room?
Mm-hmm.
And a woman is pushing and struggling to get this baby out, and people walk in and talk about the weather. Well, that's what we do with people who are dying.
I know.
And
yeah.
We don't have to. We can connect. We can be there for them. We can touch. We can listen. You know, we can validate.
But you had to go through, and I think a lot of us do, you had to go through some barriers inside to awaken that ability, didn't you? I mean, didn't you have to?
I did, and I'm writing about it, so hopefully others won't have to go through the same thing. They won't have to have the regret. They won't, they'll have information that they can work with.
What kind of people are, like, for example, when you worked with children with AIDS,
uh-huh.
Were children more receptive to crossing over than adults, for example?
Oh, absolutely. Children mm-hmm. are not fearful of death. They are taught. The fear that children have has been imposed upon them. And I don't mean directly. Children learn by watching. Children mm-hmm. learn through models. And so when they are in a family that won't talk about their illness or won't talk about their pain, children learn quickly. Oh, I can't talk about that. Oh, I can't go there. And so what happens is children end up protecting their parents instead of the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's one part of the book that I read wasn't exactly the same, but it's something about when you're touching someone who is in the dying process, what is it? Something like they can experience that as something they're supposed to do something about or supposed to respond to if you don't do it in a neutral kind of way, or do you remember that part?
Well, we communicate great deal through our touch, or through our lack of touch. We communicate a lot, and one of the reasons that I encourage people to touch is because the dying often feel as though they are ugly, dirty, certainly unacceptable and unlovable. And when we touch the dying, what we're saying, we're correcting that notion.
Mm-hmm.
Our touch is communicating, you are lovable.
Mm-hmm.
I see you as the person I've always loved.
Mm-hmm.
I'm close. I want to be close. So touch is a huge part of what the dying need because it communicates validation. They're still in the world. So often when a person receives a terminal diagnosis, people act as if they are already dead.
I know.
And I want to encourage people to live right up to their last breath. And so this book is really, it's not as much about dying as it is about how to live right up to the end and how we can help our loved ones.
Well, I think a lot of your book, as far as I can, I haven't read every single word, but as far as what I've been through, it's having the courage to release your fears and to be in interaction so that if, for example, I go back to the touch, because I was deeply touched by reading that sometimes when a person touches, it can be asking for a response from someone who's very fragile. And I thought, well, I hadn't really thought about that before.
Mm-hmm.
Because you want to be in communication in a very subtle and sensitive way, right?
Right. I want to be there for them. This isn't about me and what I need. And another example of that is that when I go to touch someone, most of us, let's say we go to the bedside of someone and we mean well and we go to hold their hand. Most of us go to hold their hand from atop.
Mm.
And if you can just picture that and what that looks like, I would ask you, who has control?
Aha. You mean
when
like...
Yes, when you hold the dying person's hand from on top, you have control. But if you were to slide your hand underneath theirs, then they can let go whenever they want to. So they have control. And that's very important because the dying person, of course, is losing all kinds of control at the end of their life.
Mm-hmm.
They have lost control often of their body and they don't have the same access to the world or access to their loved ones. They've lost dying is about losing control and letting go. So let's give them back whatever we can.
Whatever empowerment they've got.
Yes, let's empower them.
And what about the focus? Is this so that when people are dying, their focus includes a different array or different priorities, meaning, I mean, that's an obvious thing, but it's like, it seems that people's ability to attend to who you are and what news you have, for example, is diminished radically. It seems like they're paying attention to the other side or...
Yes. Well, I will tell you that dying is very hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're trying to do is relinquish the world. And so you can imagine... When you throw a pebble into a lake, there is a ripple that goes out.
For sure, yes.
Okay. When we are dying, the pebble is illness or age, and the ripple is going inward. So as we're dying, we are pulling inward, and there is less and less of the outside world that is important. We don't care about news about the weather or, politics. We are withdrawing our life force.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're with people who are dying, we need to be very gentle with our voice, our tone, and our touch, mm-hmm. our presence, because otherwise we kind of jar them back here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to let them withdraw. And that's why creating the environment is very, very important. No drama, no loud music. Everything's soft, and they will pay attention to the other side, and we need to validate that. And because validating connection with deceased loved ones who've gone before is very important, this happens much more commonly than is written about. But the person who's dying often will see, a mother, a grandmother, or someone who has died before them. And usually, if we inquire gently, and I'm not talking about probing, but just inquire openly, the message of the deceased loved one is always, I'm here, it's okay, you'll be okay. And so, of course, we would want to validate that instead of, as I've often seen, people dismissing that experience as though it was because of medication or they're hallucinating or something like that. Why would we take away comfort from someone?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, But what about medication? Isn't that sometimes, because what you just said about seeing people on the other side, that is comforting. Sometimes medication blocks that, doesn't it?
Sometimes.
Pain blocks it, I guess.
Yeah, I think pain blocks it more. And so medication is important. You know, one of the reasons that the dying are not afraid of physical pain is because, especially with a terminal diagnosis and the intervention of hospice and palliative or comfort care, there's no reason why any of our loved ones need to die in pain.
Okay.
No, people do not need to die in pain. There is medication out there that can keep it under control. And so I'm all for easing a person's pain so that they can disconnect from their body, and the pain reminds them that they're connected to their body, you see.
Mm. So many ways to go with this. I want to, children, you take children into where people are dying, is that right?
I do.
Yes.
I do, because I work a lot with hospice situations, so oftentimes the people are dying at home, and what I try to teach the families is there are many, many very helpful, healthy, significant ways that young children can participate. Mm-hmm. And when they are allowed, their fear of death is reduced, and it's a great comfort to the person who is dying. So, for example, grandma is dying in the home, and without education or intervention, oftentimes they will keep a six-year-old away from grandma.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say, no, you know, let's let the six-year-old get up on the bed and cuddle with grandma, because it's that six-year-old who will ask grandma about the same stories over and over and over again. Grandma, tell me about the time. Tell me about your most favorite school teacher. Grandma, tell me what job you loved most. And truly, the dying person needs to tell the story about their life over and over and over again so that they come to understand the significance of their life and the legacy that they will leave. But most other people, instead of young children who love the same story over and over again, most other people will dismiss the dying person and say, oh, you've already told me that.
Yeah.
But the dying needs to tell their stories as often as they need to tell their stories.
Yes, for their own identity, for their own purpose.
Yeah, they come to find the meaning of mm-hmm. their life and even their illness and what it's all about. But it's oftentimes in verbalizing it that they get the ahas. So children can participate in that way. Or I'll bring in an eight-year-old and teach the eight-year-old how to gently massage grandma's hands, who are rough and cracked and dry. So, you know, this is what the eight-year-old can do. Or somebody else can brush grandma's hair. Somebody else can just sit there and read her favorite poems.
Hmm.
But children can participate in very, very meaningful ways. And then they get to see that dying isn't as horrible, as scary, as tragic as they might believe if they didn't participate.
Hmm. Now, you, jumping around a little bit, when you were 29 years old, you had a near-death experience. This must have absolutely amped up the impact of your studies on death, did it not?
It did. It did. And it absolutely... it left me with no fear of death, no anxiety, and, it healed so much, too. I learned a great deal about that and about what the illusions of death,
mm-hmm.
Because I saw my mother, who had been dead for 15 years, and she was healed and whole and beautiful, and we were able to communicate and, you know, I guess finish business, but I learned... you know, that the only thing that's important is love, and that she had taken my love with her, and that, in fact, she had always been with me.
Hmm.
And that healed so much of my past
Because you know, Tara, it wasn't lost. It was
She wasn't lost. And most importantly, the relationship was not lost. You see, we had always been in relationship. I had just not known it.
Well, so once you had that experience, could you then feel her presence more easily? Could you be awake
always.
To it, you see?
Yeah, well, yeah, now I look for it, you see?
Mm-hmm.
I expect it. I look for it. And I see her all over. And then after that experience, I was told I had to come back, that I had work to do.
Mm-hmm.
And,
who told you? Was it your higher spirit or God or...?
Whatever you want to call it,
okay.
You know, words get in the way of this huge, huge reality. It was love, this lighted love.
Absolute
mm-hmm. love, unconditional, like we don't even know here. And so I was told that I had to come back, that I had work to do, but of course I didn't know what that meant, you know, work, well, I thought, well, you better make this real clear. And
well, it seems like a near-death experience is a really wonderful post-college course as far as learning about death.
Oh, my gosh. It's a PhD. it's a PhD in the real reality. And so shortly after that, I was reading the newspaper, and there was an article on hospice, and the word yes came right off the page at me.
Oh, wow.
And I knew instantly, of course, this is the work that I'm to do, because I bring myself without any fears of what's on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And I call it the ability to be able to lean into death.
Mm-hmm.
I don't pull away from it. And people that I'm working with know that.
And you're fascinated by it, are you not?
I'm not any more fascinated by death than I am with life,
mm-hmm.
but I'm just so present to it because it's okay,
mm-hmm.
because I'm not afraid of it. There's just nothing to fear. There really isn't anything to fear.
So I want to cycle back to life after death shortly, but do you ever feel really emotional with somebody, even though you're so attuned and so intelligent and so leaning into it?
Oh, well, sure. You know, Veronica, it doesn't, just because I know this stuff doesn't mean I don't miss people.
Right. Okay.
I had real grief, profound grief, when my father died, because I missed his physical presence in my life.
Mm-hmm.
But I know in my heart, not just my head, but I know in my heart that he's with me. But I still miss, you know, I miss the way he smelled. I miss being able to lean into his old body. I miss walks on the beach. I miss hearing the stories instead of now reading them.
Mm-hmm.
But of you know, I miss him. But I also know that he's with me now, and I'll be with him again.
Hmm.
But I feel, and there is sadness in parting. So I don't want to minimize any of that.
No. I just know that sometimes we can get caught emotionally, even when we think we won't do that. I don't mean just because he's gone, but I mean in the process of dying. Do you not get caught up sometimes in people's struggle or?
No, I guess I would say I might get caught up in, I focus on the way they construe it to be a tragedy. I mean, I think people make dying harder than it has to be when they clamp up and are very tense with fear and anxiety, or when they have not finished business, when they don't use it as an opportunity. I feel sad about that, because this could be the most intimate time of their life, and oftentimes families or the individual is making it a train wreck, that it
mm-hmm.
doesn't have to be.
Mm-hmm.
It does not have to be that way.
So what about how people die? How much choice do we have? I noticed you mentioned something that I've heard about a lot, which is you can be around the dying person all the time, and you can go out for tea or go to the potty or something, and they'll pass then.
And, right. And because
go ahead.
I see that a lot. I've seen that a lot. You know, I've been with thousands of people as they died, and It never surprises me, depending on the family dynamics. Mm-hmm. I'm not making any judgment, but oftentimes it is very difficult for a family to let a loved one go. Mm-hmm. And it's as though they are holding on. And so I'll be with a whole family and they finally leave the room to perhaps go home and take a shower or something. And I sit with the dying person and they've left and 5 minutes later the person dies.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that often as, you know, either it was too difficult one way or the other to die with them there. Sometimes I think it's the dying person's gift to them that maybe they know the family members and it would be too difficult to have that be the last image of their loved one. Or the dying person just isn't given permission to go on with the natural process. Okay. So I think that there is an unconscious, mm-hmm. Deeper level control of when a person dies,
mm-hmm.
It's still a mystery. I don't know how that happens, but I've seen it a lot.
I wonder if it aligns with the personality, perhaps a very independent person.
Could be alone or something.
Could be. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's just so interesting, isn't it?
It's all okay, you know. It's just so all okay.
Yeah.
I think really coming into this world is a lot more work and even more painful than going out. And so, why don't we let it be that way?
Well, I think you've got the nail by the, you know, by the hammer or whatever, because we need to be educated. That's why, because you've described it here carefully about how our society used to be a lot more extended, a lot more organic, and we had mm-hmm. that experience in our world, didn't you?
Yeah, we just saw it, and so it was much more normal, and because it was seen more often, we were used to it, we weren't afraid of it. And we participated, you know, we touched the dying person, and when they died, we laid them out in our parlor, and we cleansed their body, and we dressed their body. The women would do that while the men were in the workshop building the coffin, and so everyone was involved.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were community. And nowadays, we don't even know when our neighbor has had a death in their family because nobody wears black armbands. There are no black wreaths on the door.
Mm-hmm.
And so we pass them on the street, not even being able to acknowledge this major change in their life because nobody talks about grief, you
mm-hmm.
know? And then so many people are uncomfortable even expressing condolences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know, I told you that I was widowed when I was quite young, and I found not only uncomfortable, but people would cross the road if they saw me coming.
I see that all the time.
Yeah.
I see that all the time, and it's so much more painful.
Oh.
You know, I tell people, you don't have to do this perfectly. You just have to participate.
Mm-hmm.
Just participate.
And it's okay if you say the wrong thing. Just say
and
hello.
So, yes, oftentimes I'll go up. I'll encourage a person just to say, I don't know what to say, but I'm thinking about you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know what to do, but I'd like to do something.
I like the story of the young girl when you were, when your mother passed.
Yeah.
You want to tell people about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was in eighth grade and in a new school and, my mother died during spring vacation and I went back to school, just a few days afterward and everybody, you know, averted their eyes. Nobody talked to me. But there was one girl, Paige Hiller. I'll never forget her and her kindness.
Oh, bless her.
And she wrote me the one and only condolence card that I received. And she just said, you know, it must be really, really sad to lose your mom or something to that effect. But just the acknowledgement. And now, how many years is it later? You know, 40 years later, I'll never forget her kindness.
No.
And another friend who walked 3 miles to get to the church for my mother's memorial service. And, you know, just those kindnesses matter.
They really make a difference.
They make a difference.
Now, when my husband was dying, we went over to Hawaii for a little while, to Maui. And I think this is a really relevant story. And he ran out of the intense narcotic drug that he was on for painkillers. And I was from Canada, so it was like crossing the border and getting drugs, you know. But I managed to get into the big hospital there. And I managed, and I think this was spirit-driven, to meet a doctor who had left a big practice in New York because of our Western ignorance of death, and he'd taken up residence in Maui, because he sat and held my hand on a bench in the sun, got me my medication, and he held my hand, and he said...
And all of that is, again, the most important thing, which is you are not alone.
Yeah, and he also said, one more thing I wanted to say, he said, I'm in Maui because they prepare for a coming death like they do for a wedding.
Yeah.
And that touched me so deeply, you know?
It's a celebration. It's a celebration.
Yep. And
a transition, a celebration. Let's be there for them. Yes.
Yeah. He changed
my
life.
How lovely.
Yeah.
How lovely.
Yes. I'm sure he's probably not alive anymore. Let's talk about, but he has made a big difference. I know he did, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the near-death experiences and what you see on the other side. Because I want to throw another thing in is sometimes... the people on the other side come and see me, and they come to talk to clients about what's been, what they left unfinished, or angers that can be completed. Have you had any experiences like that? Or,
well, what I know because of my near-death experience is that there really is very little of the ego that needs to be communicated about, and it's all about love. And people on the other side, look back here, if you want to say it that way, and they realize all of the challenges that they had were really opportunities for growth and lessons. And so I think the lesson is to put aside the differences and connect around the love. That we are all different. I didn't feel any anger on the other side. I just felt love.
That's wonderful.
Love and understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's another thing that I'm thinking is, I had somebody that I broke up with years ago, and I should have, and yet I never really quite got over him. So sitting with another friend who was dying a few months ago, I went back and emailed him to say, it's been 18 years. Do you think we could have a cup of tea? Well, Lonnie, he died then.
Oh.
He never got my...
But he received what he needed from you.
I hope so. He keeps standing here. That's why I'm telling the story.
I would say to you, you know, say to him right now what you were going to say over the cup of tea.
Mm-hmm.
It's never too late.
Exactly. That's what I want to say is that it is never too late, that a lot gets unhooked by the loving, like you said, the loving reality of where people are.
Right. And so you see, if someone isn't with their loved one when they do die, it's not the end of the opportunity. We just keep communicating and keep talking. So whatever business, I would tell your audience, whatever business you think is left unfinished or those things that are left unsaid, go at it and trust that it is received.
So even if you're talking about if someone is passing, is dying, and it's not finished yet.
Yeah.
And
you still have the opportunity. Say it now.
Even though it might be socially disruptive, right?
Well, how would it be socially disruptive? Usually it's about, here are the five things that the dying usually need at the end of life to hear. I love you.
Mm-hmm.
I forgive you. Please forgive me. Your life mattered, and the last is, it's okay to let go.
Hmm.
And beyond that, you know, so much is covered in, please forgive me.
Mm-hmm.
Please forgive me for anything that I said or did that was hurtful to you. And I forgive you for anything you said or did to me, intentional or unintentional. It's done. It's over. It doesn't matter.
So, and you know what I love about that is the way you've been talking, and the way I think we all understand is that it's just the love that could keep us connected. So, you've said this a number of times in your book, it's the love that moves on, you know.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm cheekier than you. I say it's not about a hairdo. It's not about your clothes.
Oh, goodness. Oh, yeah. Who cares?
And it's not about your PhD, and it's not about, you know.
Oh, who cares? Right.
I know. And, but
right.
Bottom line, it's a big play, isn't it?
It's, you know, let's have the moral courage to love.
I love
that. Let's take the risk. Let's be vulnerable. Let's do the work now. Because it's just an opportunity.
One thing I keep reading is live every day into, you said lean into dying. I'm going, live every day in toward your dying sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Which
and
is
I
essentially
think,
what you're saying.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the big things that the near-death experience taught me is that is to live every day as though it's my last.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, really, if I walk out of here today and I'm hit by a car, I've said what I need to say to the people I need to say it to. They know me.
That's wonderful, huh?
So
How would you recommend people who want to break free from this kind of lock that so much of our society has against talking about death, how do you get them to start? What would you like to recommend?
Find someone who is open to talking about it and practice.
Mm-hmm. Your book is a good one.
Yeah, there you go. Pick up No One Has to Die Alone.
Right.
I write about it a lot on my blog. I blog for psychologytoday.com. They can find Lonnie Leary there. I also have my own website at Dr. Lonnie Leary, and I bring up a lot of these things and questions, and I guess I would encourage people to just start reflecting on their own death, their values, what they want, what's unfinished. Just start with themselves, and then share that. Share that with one person that's safe, one person who will listen to them, and then just start expanding that circle.
I love that. And you have also a lot of kind of lists here, like the list that you just gave on I love you, I forgive you, all of that. But you have a number, I'm trying to flip through it quickly, but you've got a number of ways that people can check out what their rapport is with people, right?
There are a lot of little toolkits in the book that they can refer to, and they're just great. They're great ways to start conversations.
And then what about grief? How would you guide people on grief?
Oh, boy.
That's a huge subject.
Yeah, that's another radio show.
Good. Well, you'll come on to that, I hope.
I often
think grief is the reason we write the book Dance the Dance, Expand, and it's a very spiritual thing, isn't it?
Well, grief, boy,
okay, we'll do this on another show.
Yeah, grief is more than 5 minutes, but we need to validate grief. We need to listen to people's grief. We need to honor people's grief because there's a story in our grief, and we can find meaning. And when I do grief work with people, there are some really helpful questions that can help them frame their grief and contain it so it doesn't overwhelm them or they're not disabled by it, but they can be informed by it.
You have some of those right in this book too, don't you? This has been very, very interesting. I feel like we'll have to have you on again because I'm just at the beginning of really getting into some pretty pithy questions for you.
Well, I'd love to speak with you again, Veronica. Thank you.
And one more time, what is your, it's Dr. Lonnie Leary, is that it?
Yeah, my website is www.drlanileary.com. So www.drlonnieleary.com is my website, and then I blog for Psychology Today, and my column is called No One Has to Be Alone.
Wonderful. I'm going to spend some time on it myself. I thank you so much for the time you spent with us today, and it's been very elucidating, very expanding for me. Thank you.
My honor. Thank you for your interest.
All right. And thank you so much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. And if you'd like to be in touch with Dr. Leary, you've got her information, Dr. Lonnie Leary, .com, right?
Uh-huh.
That's pretty easy.
Yeah.
And Psychology Today. Her blog is on there, Dr. Lonnie Leary. So thank you so much for listening, and many blessings, everyone. Good night.
Okay. Aloha.
Aloha.